Good evening. This is the Perpetual Notion Machine. My name is Kelly Schwartz, and tonight I'm presenting the latest in my ongoing series, Curriculum Vocal. Do you think people change? Do you think people can change? Have you ever changed your mind on a matter after being firmly entrenched on one side? Can you think of anyone who has honestly, truly changed their minds about problematic issues when presented with dissenting evidence? This almost never happens. In fact, the opposite is almost always true. There is a cognitive bias called the backfire effect that causes people who encounter evidence which challenges their beliefs to reject that evidence and to strengthen their support of their original stance. The backfire effect takes hold of us when others confront us with evidence that runs contrary to what we believe. It's our natural instinct to hold out, to stand our ground, and to fight off any interlopers attempting to upend our tightly guarded beliefs. This is why arguments over dinner will never yield the desired effect. And yet scientists are trained to maintain plasticity of the mind that allows us to guess, to make mistakes, to hypothesize again and regroup. In order to make progress in research, we must be able to change our minds and challenge our most closely held beliefs. This process is so unnatural that we often end up compartmentalizing its effects to project-related studies so that we don't fracture our own egos or appear so disconnected from our opinions that we come to embody hammy old Brent Spiner playing Data on Star Trek: The Next Generation. The choice is each of ours to take as to whether or not we grow beyond our tightly held beliefs. Choices are made to be used. The question is, why do scientists make that choice? When you combine a contrarian by trade with a background in punk rock philosophy, they become mercurial, a thermonuclear chemical reaction. Conventional wisdom and customary activism warps under the pressure of the incendiary mind.
And I guess I got behind it a little bit, too. It might be a little bit like we talked about the punk rock ethos, in that I saw mainstream environmentalism shunning nuclear power. So maybe it's the rebel in me that, you know, wanted to speak up for what I see as the underdog, nuclear power.
On today's program, I speak with Stephen Raymond, a PhD and researcher at Oak Ridge National Laboratories in Knoxville, Tennessee. Stephen took an unusual path to becoming a scientist that eventually led him to a lifelong fascination with corrosion and nuclear energy systems. Stay tuned.
All right, well, why don't we just get started with, why don't you introduce yourself, what you do, and how you are involved in science?
Sure. So my name is Stephen Raymond. I'm a corrosion scientist at Oak Ridge National Laboratory.
All right, and how long have you been at Oak Ridge?
Let's see, I've been here 2 years now. I graduated from the University of Michigan in 2016 with a PhD in nuclear engineering, but specializing in materials. Mm-hmm. And my thesis work was on corrosion in nuclear reactors. So I came on board Oak Ridge as a corrosion scientist.
Okay. And Oak Ridge is in Knoxville, Tennessee?
Yeah. Well, just outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. It's in a town of Oak Ridge.
Okay.
It was originally like one of the Manhattan Project sites. They built it in kind of a secret location that was kind of a little bit far from everything.
Mm-hmm.
So they could kind of do the science, you know, in secret. But as it pivoted from weapons production to peaceful uses of science, they built up the infrastructure was already there. So it was a good pivot.
That's really interesting.
It's close enough. I live in Knoxville, though.
Sure. So what do you do there now? Like, what does a normal day kind of look like for you in your work?
So I'm a staff scientist. I kind of manage a number of projects related to corrosion. So I specialize in nuclear power, and that's my main interest. So I have some projects where I study corrosion inside current nuclear reactors. One of the problems I work on is, let's see, so we all know about Fukushima, and what a lot of people don't know is that was a corrosion problem, that kind of when there was a loss of coolant in Fukushima, the cladding, the fuel cladding, it's the stuff that holds the fuel kind of in place, holds the nuclear fuel together, it corroded rapidly during this accident and released hydrogen, and that's what kind of made the explosion at Fukushima. So one of the things we're working on right now is trying to find a better material for this cladding, the stuff that holds the nuclear fuel together, one that doesn't release hydrogen in an accident scenario. to kind of make these things even safer. So it still has all the good properties of the material we use. It's called zircaloy, but doesn't have this one kind of negative consequence. One of the other projects I work on, we're working on developing this new type of nuclear reactor called a molten salt reactor, and it has a lot of positive qualities. Economics is the big one. We can kind of run it more economically in the future, but corrosion is a big problem in it because it's filled with hot molten salt and it corrodes materials. So I'm working on developing innovative materials and innovative chemistry to try to help solve this problem. And then I've got a smattering of a few other projects here and there, kind of largely where my interests lie. I have some projects sort of looking at fundamental science of corrosion. I have a few projects where we're looking at irradiation and corrosion together. I have one where I work on solar energy. We use these molten salts for concentrating solar plants, which are totally cool, kind of new kind of solar energy. And we're very interested in that. I've got a lot of projects. This is one aspect of life at the National Lab, which is really great, is I get to work on a number of things and I get to sort of follow my scientific interests largely.
Mm-hmm.
Think of myself a little bit as a project manager in that the actual work in the lab is usually done by technicians
mm-hmm.
or I have some graduate students and postdoc, and they tend to do the actual lab work.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still doing the work of a scientist in that I analyze the result myself and I still write the papers
mm-hmm.
and do all those things. So I would say the most of the aspects of, say, being a scientist in academia or industry or any place else, but
mm-hmm.
the actual hands-on part is done by others, which is a good thing because
mm-hmm.
I'm a really clumsy dude. And I assume if I were to be a hands-on scientist for the rest of my life, it would probably be a big disaster for me. My colleagues from grad school would probably laugh hearing that and nod knowingly. But yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up? How did you come into enjoying science as a younger person?
I don't know if I had a lot more exposure to science than anyone else, but my dad was into computers. And back in the days when that was kind of like a weird hobby to have when people didn't have them around, my dad had a mm-hmm. computer. So I was into playing around with them when I was young. I was a nerdy kid, like a lot of scientists. But I kind of maybe turned away from that. Around the age of 15, I discovered punk rock, and science kind of took a little bit of a backseat in my life for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I actually then went to school. I did not get good grades in high school, actually. I was, what you'd say, I didn't apply myself well. So I went to a not very good college and studied music and got a bachelor's degree in music right out of high school. And I say this, I was very untalented. I liked music and it was fun, but I definitely wasn't good enough to be a career musician or make any kind of career in the music business. But whatever, I did it anyway. And then after that, so after graduating college, I went to work, I think, for a payroll company in Rochester. I worked in a cubicle. I did IT type work. I still had some experience with computers. So I did that for a few years, but I found myself very bored with it. And I decided I wanted to go save the world. And I was interested in environmentalism. And I was maybe still a bit of an iconoclast from my younger days as a punk rock loving teen. And decided I'd like to, do something for the environment. But I also, I wanted a better challenge as well. So I decided to go back to school and study physics, but you can't go get a PhD in physics with a bachelor's in music, I found. So I went back and got a second bachelor's degree in physics, and that was great. I really enjoyed physics. I did well at it, and that was at the University of Buffalo. So from there, I kind of was, as I learned physics and learned about ways to that I could make an impact, I decided, nuclear power was a great way to help the environment. I liked it as an energy source. And from what I was, reading, it was probably our best solution for helping to stop climate change. So I applied to do my PhD in nuclear engineering, and I did that at the University of Michigan. And I decided I would specialize in materials for nuclear power plants, just because that was research I did as an undergraduate, and I was interested in condensed matter physics and material properties and those kinds of things. So I thought it would be fun to apply that in nuclear reactors. So that's what led me to work with my advisor, Gary Woz, was known for this sort of work. And I kind of just landed on a project that had to do with corrosion. It had to do with irradiation accelerated corrosion, or the effect of radiation on corrosion in nuclear power plants, and figuring out what the effect of radiation is on the corrosion. So as happens to a lot of scientists, you know, we often don't really know the path we're going to take. It just kind of falls on us. But I ended up enjoying it. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was doing. And then I guess we've already talked about what happened from there. Then I went to Oak Ridge. Yeah. So when it came close to graduating, actually, I started looking when I was about a year out from graduating. I started calling the people who, you know, were in positions at places I wanted to work. And actually, I had Oak Ridge. It was at the top of my list. I knew I wanted to go to Oak Ridge, just because Oak Ridge is the lab that's most well known for materials science. And, you know, even though my PhD is in nuclear engineering, I consider myself a materials scientist because I worked on materials. So Oak Ridge is where I wanted to go. And I knew a number of researchers at Oak Ridge. When I'd go to conferences, they were the ones who were like doing this great work. And I was like, that's where it's at. That's where I want to be. So I reached out to people I knew at Oak Ridge and, you know, let them know I was looking. So there was an opening. So I again reached out to everybody and they said, apply for it. I actually didn't think I could get it, because I thought I was going to have to do a postdoc first. As most of us, you got to do a postdoc before you can get a staff position.
Yeah.
But the staff position came open and I like reached out to some of my contacts. I was like, you know, I'd like to come do this work, but it's a staff. I'm not qualified. And they said, just apply for it and see what you can do. So yeah, fortunately, I went in for the interview and I was thinking, okay, they're going to still give me a postdoc. Like, I know I'm here for this staff position, but they're going to like, okay, are you going to take a postdoc? Surprisingly, they gave me this full-time position. So I was very happy about that. There were some other places I'd considered as well. I didn't actually have any other hard offers, just because I was so sure I wanted to come to Oak Ridge. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to, you know, build nuclear reactors to go in submarines. I wanted to, I'm a big hippie and wanted to make peaceful reactors to save the environment. So
I'd also really want to talk about how you came around to seeing nuclear power as a solution to a world's problem. To say that nuclear power has a lot of conflicts with that value system. So how was it that you came to sort of see nuclear power as being an important way to invest yourself in energy production?
Yeah. I mean, that's a really good question. I discovered nuclear power, you know, originally thinking the same like most people do. It seems nuclear power is the enemy. It's big business. You know, these corporations, the same people who own nuclear plants are the ones who own the coal plant. And, you know, they just want to make money and they don't care about anyone. And there's kind of the natural reaction is the people doing renewables, they're small business. It's the egalitarian way to generate energy. But I guess to really analyze this situation, you got to maybe move beyond the initial impression of these things and you got to do the math. I guess that's what I always say, is you got to do the math. And you can start to realize there's a lot of problems with solving global warming without nuclear power. There's sort of maybe two avenues to talk about this. And the first is talking about how we need nuclear power to solve global warming, that we can't realistically do it with renewables alone. And the other thing we got to say is, like, nuclear power is a lot safer than you think it is. And a lot of the problems that people have brought up with nuclear power are like less of a deal than you think they are. For like the waste issue is, I hesitate to just like go out and say this, but like, it's a lot less of a deal than you think it is. And it's funny, I can start to sound preachy when I talk about nuclear power, and I sound even defensive. Like, I'm like, it's not that big of a deal. And then I start talking about all the reasons why this is fine. And it kind of sounds like I'm an industry apologist or a shill, and you know, and I try not to. I'm trying to just like back this up with I'm just a scientist trying to, you know. So in the first place, let me start with when we need to look at how we're going to solve global warming, and we need to transition transition to, carbon-free energy sources. And I do believe we need to get nearly 100%, not exactly, but we need to mostly phase out fossil fuels. But to do that, it's just really, really hard to do with variable sources. So we have, wind, we have solar, and they're variable, of course. So you need to store them. And storing energy is so much harder than people realize to do. To build batteries on the scale that would be necessary for this, it's just astronomical. Just the amount of lithium that you would need to store that amount of energy. It's just like getting batteries in at that scale. It's kind of not realistic. And it comes from doing the math. If you don't do the math, you say to yourself, the price of batteries are going down. Look at Tesla's got these power walls now. Batteries are coming up. We're going to solve all our problems. But you got to actually do the math to really see how unrealistic that is. And other means of energy storage, people talk about pumped hydro, meaning instead of batteries, doing things like you can pump water uphill or up mountains, and that stores the energy, and then you let it flow down through a dam eventually. And that has geographic limitations. You can only do so much of that. So you kind of have to do the math. And even when you add up all these kind of energy storage solutions that are out there, even the ones that are technically feasible, even the ones that aren't that technically feasible, the numbers don't really add up. And you say to yourself, well, we need still a way to generate baseload energy, energy that's on all the time that we can rely on. And that's what coal provides us, and that's what natural gas provides us. So we need to figure out a way to do that without emitting carbon. And nuclear power is the only way we have to do that. Well, I should say hydro also does that. Hydro is great, but hydro is geographically limited. Pretty much in the United States, it's maxed out. Wherever we can build hydroelectric power, we pretty much have. So Nuclear is really the only scalable baseload electricity source that we have. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm a big booster of it. And I guess I got behind it a little bit, too. It might be a little bit like we talked about the punk rock ethos. Mm-hmm. In that I saw mainstream environmentalism shunning nuclear power. So maybe it's the rebel in me that wanted to speak up for what I see as the underdog, nuclear power, and why that needs to be part of the mainstream environmental movement. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's funny saying that it feels like the underdog, too, because, I mean, currently it's 20% of our nation's electricity. So, and it dwarfs every other source of carbon-free energy. I mean, hydro is about 9 or 10%. Wind is maybe about 5 or 6%, and solar is like less than 1%. So nuclear is still like the biggest producer of carbon-free electricity by a lot, but it kind of feels like an underdog when you look at as part of the mainstream environmental movement. Mm-hmm. Although I think the mainstream environmental movement is coming around. This was just a few days ago. This kind of made big headlines. The Union of Concerned Scientists, which had been, I would say, often a rather unscientific environmental group, but they have come around and are now supportive of nuclear power and having traditionally been opposed to nuclear power. And there's still a few of the big so-called environmental groups that are against nuclear power, but more and more there are environmental groups popping up that are for nuclear power, as they should be, I believe.
That's good. It's good to hear.
You know, one of the images about nuclear power, people see those big cooling towers and they look like smokestacks, and people imagine radioactive pollution spilling out of them, when really what comes out of them is steam. They're cooling towers, and it's like the cleanest steam you'll ever find, and they release no pollution. But that's kind of the enduring image from The Simpsons.
Yep.
People picture nuclear waste as this glowing green ooze, mm-hmm. when in reality it's a solid form that is not water soluble and is pretty stable and safe. Mm-hmm. But that's the nuclear industry might actually need better storytellers. Better PR is what we need.
All scientists need better PR. That's why I'm here.
That's true. You're doing the most important work then.
I'm doing the lifting. Yeah. So we've talked a lot about your passion for this profession that you found yourself in and kind of your path to getting there. So when did science to you begin to feel like a career as opposed to more of just a field of study?
Oh, wow. I would say it felt pretty real when I got to grad school. And, I had a lab and I went in every day and had things that I was responsible for doing that I felt like a scientist rather than a student, mm-hmm. at that point. still had classes and still had to take direction from the advisor, of course. But I felt like, you know, I had a job to do. I had a 5 or 6 year job to do, and I had a goal, and I go into the lab every day, punch the time card, and yeah. And when I say it felt like a job too, I mean, in a way, it doesn't feel like a job. I do feel like every day, like I just go into my lab, I play with science all day. It really is a dream for me. Still at this stage, many years later. Well, not that many years later, but some years later. So I don't drag. I don't dread going into the office. In fact, I love working so much. I do it on nights and weekends, and not because I feel like I have to, but just because I want to, which my wife would prefer. I didn't work so much, but it's I do. It's a calling for me. Research is really fun. I enjoy it every day. I feel like I just play every day and pursue things that interest me, and I don't work because for the paycheck. I work because, you know, I want to figure out the problems I'm working on. So I'd say it's a definite good thing to do.
So another question that I'd like to ask is, so what are some aspects of research or study that you found challenging or kind of as obstacles to you in your career?
Oh, sure. Yeah, one of the hardest things, I think, is dealing with the money. That, you know, research needs to be funded. And I didn't have to really worry about that in grad school. And I guess ideally, most grad students shouldn't have to worry about that. Their professor kind of worries about it. But now I'm thrown into it, and I've got to manage the budgets for my projects. And I've got other people who work on my projects, you know, technicians and postdocs and other scientists. And I got to make sure they have money to cover their work and to do everything they need. And I can handle what I need. You know, people's time needs to be paid for, and the equipment needs to be paid for, and budgeting all these is, I find, very difficult. You know, I'm not an accountant, I'm a scientist. But I spend a lot of time thinking about how to manage money and resources. And that, I think that's a big challenge for me. It might be easy for others, but I'm sure, you know, we all go into this with a scientific background, and we're presented with these challenges that we have, like, no training for.
Yeah. Well, so what advice would you give to others regarding your experiences? Do you encourage other people to pursue a career in research science, or, you know, what kind of advice would you give people that were interested in maybe following your footsteps?
So I would definitely say getting a PhD is a fantastic idea. You get a lot of, you know, for the self-determination alone, you get to kind of run your lab. Working at the national lab in the first place is fantastic. It's they give me all the resources I need. I get a lot of autonomy there. I have to do some stuff because that's what I'm told to do. But for the most part, I get to work on things that I care about, that I believe in, and that I like doing. So that's great. You know, I tell this to my students and to, you know, colleagues who are still doing their PhDs, go to conferences as much as you can, cast a wide net, keep in touch with people, because your relationships are how you get a job. I mean, I guess I'm not the first person to say that, but that's advice that was handed down to me, and I found it to be true. You know, you cast a net, make sure you know people, and even more importantly, people know who you are.
All right. So just a couple more questions. I'm curious to know if your views on country music have changed since you've moved to Tennessee.
You know, I thought we would encounter a lot more country music, but I guess I've learned that maybe more confined to Nashville. It's around, you know, it's a different culture here. And what I do find, the one sort of cultural element that's huge here is college football. Now, you know, we went to University of Michigan, so college football is big there, and we're well known for college football. And I thought they were nuts about it, but I had no idea. People are absolutely nuts about the Tennessee Volunteers here in Knoxville.
I guess someone has to be.
There is a lot of people wearing creamsicle orange here all the time. It's a constant topic of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And you gotta pay attention to college football if you're around here.
So in closing, is there anything else you would like to add?
Yeah, the future's so bright. I gotta wear shades. And I have a website. It's StephenRaymond.com. There's not much on it, but I have a Twitter as well. My handle is just @StephenRaymond. No, I think we've got it pretty well covered. Thank you for having me. This was really fun to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, in talking, it sounds like you've been constantly trying new things throughout your career, and you've always found your footing and been able to pass through these trials with confidence and, you know, have come out much better for your struggles. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Regardless of how we feel about nuclear power and green energy, the fact remains that the Earth's climate is changing at an alarming rate. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is the leading world body for assessing the science related to climate change, its impacts and potential future risks, and possible response options. The report highlights a number of climate change impacts that could be avoided by limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees C compared to 2 degrees C or more. For instance, by 2100 AD, global sea level rise would be 10 centimeters lower with global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius compared with 2 degrees Celsius. The likelihood of an Arctic Ocean free of sea ice in summer would be once per century with global warming of 1.5 degrees compared with at least once per decade with 2 degrees C. Coral reefs would decline by 70 to 90% with a global warming of 1.5 degrees. Whereas virtually all would be lost with 2 degrees C. Limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius is possible within the laws of chemistry and physics, but doing so would require unprecedented changes. Global net human-caused emissions of carbon dioxide would need to fall by about 45% from 2010 levels by 2030, reaching net zero around 2050. Every bit of warming matters, especially since any warming increases the risk associated with long-lasting or irreversible changes to the environment. The decisions we make today are critical in ensuring a safe and sustainable world for everyone, both now and in the future. The next few years are probably the most important in our history. And in the fullness of time, we will need to continue to learn how to change as we adapt to our changing world. Thanks to our executive producer, Dennis Schaefer, and our engineer, Kevin Lauterjung. If you've got comments about the show or a question you'd like the PNM crew to answer, send us an email at scienceonwart@gmail.com. That's S-C-I-E-N-C-E on wart, all one word, @gmail.com. Or find us on social media. Later, nerds.